Welcome to the Washington Updates podcast from the National Association of Health Underwriters. Healthcare headlines dominated last week, including the resignation of HHS Secretary Tom Price, the failure to hold a vote on the Graham-Cassidy repeal and replace plan, and the decision not to pass a reauthorization of the Children's Health Insurance Program before funding expired last Saturday. The headlines have continued this week, with CHIP moving forward, as well as the reintroduction of legislation to bring much-needed employer reporting reforms. In this week's installment, Marcy Buckner and Chris Hartman walk us through these past 2 weeks and what we can expect as Congress and the administration move forward on health reform. Welcome to both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I want to start off this week with a question about changes happening at HHS. Last Friday, Secretary Tom Price abruptly resigned following ethics questions. President Trump named an acting secretary, but this week a new deputy secretary was confirmed for the agency. Who is in charge at HHS, and what can we expect from the agency moving forward?
Yeah, so last week was big in healthcare news, not just with Dr. Price, but in what seems to be something that's holding over from the Obama administration. The Trump administration is also giving us our Friday afternoon surprises on a regular basis. And here we had our news breaking late Friday afternoon that Dr. Price resigned as HHS secretary amid the news on the extensive flights that he had purchased by the government on private planes. And so there was a lot of pressure there surrounding what we were going to see from Dr. Price. And he did end up resigning. And I think because of the timing, when you have someone like that that resigns, you want to immediately be able to have someone in place that is able to make decisions. And so they named an acting secretary, Don Wright, to fill that position. And then earlier this week, they were able to confirm a deputy secretary, Eric Hargan. And so we are yet to see whether the deputy secretary will take over the acting secretary spot, since Don Wright, the person who was put into the acting secretary role, was a few rungs down the ladder in the hierarchy over at HHS. But we are going to go over there next week. We have a meeting with HHS, so we'll be able to get the dirt and the gossip on what's going on over there from some of the higher up officials that have been working with the Trump administration. So we'll be able to see what's going on. But I want to make sure that people know we do have great relationships over at HHS through CMS and CISIO. A lot of these folks are career staffers, so they were there through the Obama administration and still through the Trump administration. So those connections still hold tight, as well as some of the Trump appointees that we had worked with prior in the Bush administration and some that were appointed that we'd worked with in other capacities. So even though we have the figurehead is gone, Secretary Price is gone, it will affect us, but not in such a monumental way because we do still have those contacts over there. It may slow down some regulations throughout the end of the year, but that's another piece that we're trying to get the timeline on when we go and visit with them next week.
Yeah, so, you know, we're going to have to start recording these podcasts Friday night after happy hour with the way things come out around here. And maybe, Marcy, you and I can do them in another city after taking a charter flight here or there. But in all seriousness, we do work with a lot of people over HHS and CMS quite closely. To our knowledge, they're all still there. To our knowledge, none of them enjoy personal flights around the country on taxpayers' dime. So we're going to be meeting with those people next week and working on some of the regulatory changes. And, you know, regardless of who ends up with the nomination, it's not like we expect to see some drastic different direction on policy changes. A couple weeks ago, a policy directive overall for HHS was put out, and a lot of the different themes and goals working for HHS across the board, not just within the world of ACA, I don't really think are the types of things that are going to change regardless of who Trump puts in charge. You're going to have some sort of conservative Republican in charge of HHS, and that's going to kind of keep the agency moving forward in that direction. I do think we might be a little bit delayed as we go forward into seeing new regulations. But as we head into this next open enrollment period, all that stuff's already in place. How open enrollment's going to work is already in place, the timetable for it. The carriers have all certified their plans and policies. So I don't think any of that and how this open enrollment period will go will really change, even if we don't have a secretary even nominated by the time we start open enrollment.
The next question I have is, what is happening with the market stability legislation? 1 week it is happening, the next week it is not happening. Will anything be passed in time to affect 2018 rates? And what are the main issues for moving this legislation?
So we'd love to see market stability legislation, obviously. I mean, really, if you go back to looking at a CAP conference, that's what our entire theme at CAP conference was about. How to create a stable insurance market. We're the experts in the field of an insurance. And what does stability look like? How do you get there? How do you create stable rates, but also providing choice to consumers? And so we're still working on that particular point. In the Senate, there have been Chairman Alexander and Ranking Member Patty Murray, who have been working on this issue for quite some time. I think that last month when they were trying to work on this, they kind of had all the oxygen sucked out of the room with Cassidy Graham and continued repeal and replace conversations. And finally, that's all come to an end. So now we have a little bit of a window here to try to talk about market stability. And I think what you have to look at is what they pass could be a first step to passing more bipartisan pieces of legislation, but B, you got to kind of get the right mix of people. We don't want it where it would be Chairman Alexander and 40 Democrats. You know, it needs to be a situation that everybody's comfortable holding hands, singing kumbaya, and stepping over that line to pass their first piece of market stability legislation. What sort of elements are in it? I think we're kind of looking at cost-sharing reductions, which are payments that go to pay down the premium of silver-level plans. Carriers want that reliability and predictability of those payments going to be coming, as opposed to the month-to-month decision the administration is currently making out there. You know, the basics of business is about stability and predictability, and that's what really all companies, including the insurance carriers, are looking for, of some sort of stability of what sort of funds are coming in, what funds are going out, what are their tax rates going to look like. That's all the thing any sort of business is really looking for. And so they're looking to the Republican administration for some sort of predictability and stability when it comes to the issue of health insurance out there. I think after that, a lot of what Alexander and Murray are looking about are those 1332 waivers, which allow states to waive certain requirements under the ACA. And particularly, can we do something to speed this up? It takes, right now, at least 6 months for any 1332 waiver to get approved. And at this rate, you're going to have to be planning out several years in advance with the 1332 waiver. We just saw Oklahoma last week withdraw their 1332 waiver. And they specifically said they withdrew it because it just was taking too long and you can't affect the rates for the new season.
And in their application, they did have kind of a self-imposed deadline on themselves and on HHS for approval, and said that they needed to know by the end of September if this was going to move forward so they could be able to put something into place by 2018. And so when they did not have that decision from HHS at the end of the month, they decided to rescind their application and take it back. So it was the state's choice in doing that. It did have a number of different items in its proposal that some were controversial, some not as controversial, but many of them were aimed specifically at the 2018 plan year. So with that inability for HHS and the other agencies to move very quickly to approve these items, it has caused some states already to have to back off of 2018 to be able to get anything done.
Yeah, and I think when we're talking about those 2018 rates, you saw a lot of states either apply two sets of rates or put in another set of rates, depending on if those cost sharing reductions are coming out. And at this point, you know, everybody had to have the rates in. We still don't really have predictability if cost sharing reductions are in. So you're going to have states and the federal government decide, are you picking the higher rate? Which then is the assumption the cost share reductions are not there. And if those cost share reductions actually do show up, then how do you get that money back to the consumers? You don't want the carriers to pocket it. And really, they aren't looking to pocket it. They'd rather have the consumers have it also. Or do you pick the lower rates and then have risk that the carriers are going to be stuck with a huge loss, possibly 20%, when the funds aren't actually there? The last piece that they're talking about when it comes to this stability legislation is looking at some sort of copper plan / catastrophic plan with a hope of encouraging young people into the market where there's a product that they can actually afford to get out there.
And I agree with the pieces that Chris has mentioned that are expected to be included in any bipartisan packages, and I think they've all been discussed on the House and Senate side. And just want to point out, because of Graham Cassidy and Alexander Murray, there has been a lot of work here in D.C. reaching out with other industry stakeholders. There have been several groups that have come together in different formats and different sections to look at market stability for the individual market, specifically for 2018 and 2019. And NEHU has been participating with all of those groups, looking across the board at partners that we can work with to try to get anything done for 2018 and then hopefully for 2019. So even though there was, you know, all of this interest in Graham Cassidy and thinking that could be pushed through, it did not stop the processes of folks continuing to move forward and planning that it would not go through like we saw last week, and continuing to look at bipartisan fixes. So I just want to make sure to point that out, that we are still have always been engaging in that and looking at ways that we can work on a bipartisan manner.
And I think Dan's question asked about 2018 rates. Unfortunately, some of these things like 1332 waivers or copper plans, we're really not talking about something that's going to affect the 2018
no.
rates at this point. You know, the cost share reductions, I think a lot of those are now being locked in rates, and you might have at least some rebate or something going on if that comes into place. One of the things that could still have an impact is if we could at some point see a delay of the HIT tax. That's adding about 3 percentage points of cost onto every plan, or for the average individual, about $500. If we could get that to go away on any bill this year, I think that would be a good sign for 2018 and provide a little relief to rates. Any of these pieces of legislation also don't have to pass on their own. We'd be thrilled to see them attached onto transportation bill, FAA bill, an appropriations bill. We're not, Marcy and I aren't too picky.
I'm not picky. It can go on with anything.
We'll take them anywhere. So we'll be looking at any opportunity on any bill that's passing, be it healthcare related, like children's health insurance plan, or any sort of tax bill that's going through. We're happy to see any of these stability measures go through. We don't feel any need for personal ownership over them or its own title. So we'll keep pushing for that. And there are a few senators who feel strongly about this the way we do. And so we're going to be working with them to see something happen.
Earlier this week, legislation was introduced in both the House and Senate to make much needed reforms to the ACA's employee reporting requirements. What does this legislation do, and what has NEHU been doing to call for these changes?
This is revisiting of the employer reporting bills that we introduced within the last congressional session. There was a lot of interest in those over the past 2 years. Unfortunately, because of other issues in the political climate, we weren't able to get those passed. So this allows for a prospective reporting system as opposed to what we have currently with what you're working for with your employer clients. And this is something that we think would alleviate a lot of the burdens on the large employers and others. It's also something that we have tried to gain traction with when we're looking at ways that we can have regulatory relief, specifically through Treasury, and are really using all of the advocacy avenues that we can with working on this by two-prong process. Well, looking at legislation and ways that we can affect employer reporting, and also with our comments and meetings that we have coming up with Treasury to see what can be done on that front as well. We know that this has caused an extreme burden on our members and your employer clients. And so trying to alleviate the mass and duplicative system with employer reporting is something that's on the top of our list when we're looking at ways that we can try to advocate for a bit of change. And because this is looking at one piece in the system here, we're not asking for a repeal of anything. We're just looking at ways that we can make the system work better. So it can have some enticement on a bipartisan level to try to get support from both sides, and it's not as polarizing as some other issues that may come up. So this is something that, like Chris mentioned with some of the other bills that we could see on a standalone basis, like the HIT tax, is something that we could see possibly getting support on both sides and attaching and moving along with something else.
Yeah, so anybody, any agent or broker who works with an employer knows the employer reporting system is burdensome. It's not very practical. It causes a lot of different privacy concerns out there, including the fact that employers now are required to collect all their dependent Social Security numbers. And in this age of data breaches everywhere, who wants everybody's Social Security number around everywhere? We've already seen Equifax hand out all our personal data to every bad guy out there. So this is obviously something an employer doesn't want any responsibility over either. And so one of the things that the bill does is eliminate employers collecting that Social Security number, because handing that number over to the IRS is nothing that you need to do to actually match data between if employers providing a family plan for health insurance or not. That sort of information and data has been proven to be able to be collected through things like last names, date of birth, and with the IRS personal filings. So I think a lot of these sorts of thefts can be done, and this personal information doesn't have to be handed out there where it's vulnerable to attack. This was a topic last year. I was utterly convinced we were going to have passed and fixed. Any senator or congressman who is willing to take the time and really understand the details of employer reporting, and admittedly, that is a small universe who wants to get into that level of the weeds, but sees the problem out there. And this has not been a topic that's a particularly Democratic or Republican issue. Both sides, when they really look at this, see that there's a better way to have run the system. And I think, you know, prior to Election Day, we were looking very likely for this to be one of the pieces of legislation that passed in the lame duck. But the election happened. Congress and the senators and the powers that be were out there decided they didn't want to make any tweaks or changes to the ACA. So,
well, that's because they were going to repeal it when they came.
It was all just going to go away. So who would need employer reporting to begin with? Even though all the different reconciliation plans would have required some sort of reporting out there. But I think now that we're past reconciliation, there is another possibility here, another window for getting a more reasonable system, allowing an employer to say upfront, I offer health insurance for my employees and here are their names. This is also really great for consumers because when they go on healthcare.gov and they put their name in and data in, that would allow people to, up ahead of time for it to pop up on the screen and say, you have an offer of coverage from your employer. You can't get health insurance here without paying full freight. And this is important for the employees at that point because if any employee is getting health insurance on healthcare.gov and getting that tax credit, but they have an offer of coverage from their employer, they're going to have to pay all of that back on their taxes in the end out there. Because if you have an offer of coverage from your employer, you're not eligible for that tax credit. And, you know, there's possibility out there that there are a lot of employees who didn't understand what was offered to them, didn't understand that it was coverage, thought going on healthcare.gov sounded better. And so they're not realizing how much they're going to actually owe in back taxes out there. And if there was just a simple way to say, oh, my employer's, it pops up on the screen, my employer's offering healthcare, then you'd have all these people steered back to getting their employer healthcare, get those participation rates up, and not leaving this poor employee in the hole for large amounts of tax dollars. So I'm hopeful that we have some possibility of seeing this move forward.
Yeah, it's pro-consumer and pro-business, and it's hard to vote against that.
So in addition to the employer reporting legislation, NIHU was also excited about the introduction of companion legislation to include brokers as stakeholders in the Medicare notices. What does this legislation do, and what would it mean for agents and brokers who sell Medicare?
So this is what we call the Binney's Bill, and it was something that we thought, once again, we would see passed at the end of the session last year as possibly being added into the 21st Century Cures Bill. It was not included, but that allowed us some extra time with speaking with some of the other stakeholders with this bill. What it does is it addresses the notices that go out to folks that are about to become Medicare eligible, and it looks at the language that goes out to them to try to make sure that it is consumer friendly, that it is easy to understand. I'm sure many of you who work in the Medicare market or have aged into Medicare understand just how difficult this can be when you're receiving these notices, and then you're also receiving things from other organizations that may not be as clear. And so this looks at the language that goes out, but it also puts together, it doesn't make a template or provide the draft language for that, but it does make a list of stakeholders that should be included when discussing what should be in the notice. And so in that list of stakeholders, agents and brokers are included as a group that needs to be consulted when the drafting of this language is put together. So once this bill passes, which hopefully it will pass, we will have a seat at the table with drafting these Medicare notices, and hopefully we'll be able to utilize our Medicare working group and some information possibly gathered at some of our Medicare summits to be able to add in to the conversation here as they're making those drafts and putting these notices together.
And this is a big win for NAHU. On earlier versions of this bill that were introduced, health insurance agents and brokers weren't included. And when we were looking at this legislation and pointed out that groups were going to be getting together under this legislation and we're working with the government to talk about how people would see Medicare notices, we went to them and said, you have to include agents and brokers in this. They're the ones who actually are going to be working with employers when their employees are looking at moving into Medicare, or when people are moving into Medicare and getting Medicare Advantage. Without the agent and broker, they're the ones who are really going to be communicating information out there. So the authors of the legislation understood what we were talking about. We persuaded them of the importance of the agent and broker. And so if this legislation moves through, the agents and brokers are going to make sure that they have a voice at the table about how individuals should receive information about Medicare, Medicare Advantage, and other programs, and making sure people sign up, but preserving that important relationship that we have with the individual and employer.
Yeah, and it's really interesting the way that this is written. So it doesn't charge. Normally when something like this is put together and they're talking about needing a notice or needing a specific document like this, normally the legislation then charges an agency with that. And here we would assume that they would charge HHS with developing this. But instead of charging an agency to develop these notices, it charges a group to work on this as a suggestion to HHS. So we're able to get in on that first level, on the drafting level with these notices. And it's not something where, like we do routinely now, we submit comments on pieces that are released by agencies. We'd actually be included in this group that is provided for in statute, if this passes, that must be consulted in the development of the notice.
Finally, the Children's Health Insurance Program technically expired last Saturday. This is one of few bipartisan-supported healthcare programs. If not even this bill could get passed before the deadline, what does it mean for other healthcare legislation? In the meantime, what are states supposed to do?
So right now, I don't want anyone to panic. I know we have a lot of agents that follow the CHIP program or have family or friends that are covered by the CHIP program. At this point, at the first week of October, no states have run out of funding for their CHIP program, and it will take until the end of the year for any states to face that moment, and it will be only a handful of states. However, saying that, there is the possibility of Congress passing the funding and extending CHIP before the end of this month, or even within the next couple of weeks before mid-month, is very high. We are expecting them to do that. They were on track somewhat to get it done by September 30th. There was a chance they could have done it. We didn't see them do it because there was a lot of other things on their plate. If they were going to get through reconciliation, it absolutely had to be done by September 30th. However, with the September 30th deadline on the CHIP reauthorization, that was a deadline to, just like it sounds, reauthorize the funding. And because there is funding that's left that states are able to use right now, it doesn't mean that the plan disintegrates, that it goes away because they didn't reauthorize it. So we are kind of in this limbo period. However, it is something that can be addressed, and the likelihood of it being addressed before any states run out of funding is very high. So we're not expecting to get into that crisis point where states are scrambling to be able to continue the programs within their borders. But I don't want to dismiss the importance of them acting very swiftly and as quickly as possible to go ahead and reauthorize the plan.
Yeah, so we have a little time here because, as Marcy pointed out, states do have funding left over. The difficulty is, again, on this timing. It's not like a government shutdown where money runs out and the government shuts national parks and other programs down. The difficulty here is because it's an insurance program, many pieces are paid forward. As you know, premiums are paid out throughout the year and you're planning for it. CHIP kind of works a similar sort of way. So the difficulty that the states are going to be having is if they don't have certainty that the money is coming, how do they tell families to stay on CHIP? And shouldn't they be warning people to find other arrangements if their health insurance is going to be running out. States that say it would run out of funds completely in January, but may have the money now, should at some point they start warning people to come up with other arrangements before January and allow them maybe to try to find a plan through open enrollment or some other place there. So at some point you have to give people a heads up that this money might not be coming. And we don't want to be all alarmist on one hand and make everyone panic, but there is a certain level of responsibility that at some point where you have to tell people that the federal government hasn't come through and your children will be without health insurance. You should come up with some other arrangement. And so that's why I don't think we can actually wait until the state is out of money to pass any sort of pieces of legislation. There is hope. I mean, bipartisan agreement was came to on the Senate side for a 5-year reauthorization of the CHIP program. So we talked about CHIP is wildly popular on both sides of the aisle. The House is a little different, a little less bipartisan there. There's a disagreement on where the funds for that should come from. But we are hopeful that in the coming weeks, the House and Senate can come to some agreement on this. This needs to be done sooner rather than later because it's just, like I said, not one of those things that you can go over the deadline or right up to the deadline and not have real-world consequences. It's like so many things in health insurance, the Cadillac tax that you can't wait till all January 20th to really deal with it because there are implications like raising deductibles and other things as we prepare for Cadillac tax. Children's health insurance program has the same sort of real-world implications for children out there, and so Congress needs to get their acting gear.
Our thanks to Marcy Buckner and Chris Hartman for joining us in this week's podcast for the Washington Update from the National Association of Health Underwriters. Thank you for listening.